Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for downloading our podcast this week. I'm John Montgomery. As promised, today is part three of our series looking at the feature film Avatar, a film that is still killing it at the box office, having just this week surpassed Titanic as the number one grossing film of all time with over $1.8 billion. Pretty impressive that James Cameron has the top two grossing films of all time. I certainly wouldn't turn away from pitching feature film to me, to say the least. While that's an impressive number, it is interesting to take a look at Gone with the Wind, which, if adjusted for inflation, is the number one grossing film of all time. It made about $400 million at the time it came out, but adjusted for today's dollars, that's $6 billion in today's dollars. So quite impressive on both counts, Avatar and what Gone with the Wind did back in the day. Well, today's podcast is a two-parter. In the second part of the podcast today, Mike Seymour is going to be speaking with Christian Kestner, compositing supervisor from Framestore. They worked on several sequences in the film. But in part one of the podcast, Mike's going to be chatting with Dana Batali of Pixar's RenderMan team. Now, of course, RenderMan was used on the feature film Avatar by various houses. And one really big aspect of RenderMan is it's really built with complex scenes and large-scale projects in mind. If you think of the kind of rich detail that was visible in the CGI renders in Avatar, you've got to imagine the amount of data that's generated. And one aspect about managing that data is Pixar's Rays algorithm, which is used for displacement mapping, really efficient displacement mapping. Basically, what happens is that it does displacement mapping at the time of the renderer, so it can take into account the camera position, the position of the objects in the scene, to really determine the level of detail which needs to be made in order to create a very high-quality render. Now, Batali contrasts this with what might happen if you introduce that level of complexity earlier in the process tree.
Now, if you were to pre-displace all the geometry before the renderer even sees it, like some displacement subsystems do in some renderers, it would simply be untenable to produce the number of polygons and keep those around for the entirety of the renderer. So that's where sort of the magic of the Rays architecture comes in play, is to produce micropolygons just in time and to make those deformable by shaders just in time, and then throw them away very quickly so that you can keep your memory footprint into the megabytes and gigabytes and not the terabytes, which really is the number of bytes that a typical film quality renderer deals with. Is the number of texels and the number of micropolygons gets into the terabytes for a single frame.
I'm wondering in terms of the size of the data sets we're talking about, and of course the complexity of the film requiring such a vast render farm. Are you aware of any kind of, I don't want to use the word tricks, but approaches in terms of dealing with this in terms of RenderMan? Because there's sort of like two schools of thought with a RenderMan pipeline, isn't there? There's really that sort of effects multi-pass school, and there's also the sort of nail it in the one pass or two or three passes in through a primary render as opposed to doing a multi-pass render. Are you aware of any approaches to get around the vast data sets and enormous complexity of the film?
Oh, gosh, I'll bet, I know certainly that they baked no shortage of spherical harmonics and tried to capture some of the soft illumination computations in pre-passes. To the degree that that can be done on a per jungle element once and for the entire show, that was one of the ways I believe that, one can deal with the kind of shading complexity. The fact that these plants are being populated into a shot, there's a technique that reduces the number of plants in a shot according to visibility information, and that was kind of described at our users group meeting at SIGGRAPH last fall. Those are two examples. The gamut, the techniques range the entire gamut from geometry reduction, the use of brick maps for objects in the distance, which are basically voxel representations of geometry rather than fully elaborated topological meshes or something like that. That's a technique. As far as the difference in numbers of passes and whatnot, I believe that every film quality render that doesn't involve just a single kind of CG character, that in fact has complete CG sets, has to bake something. Well, and the simplest and most common bake is some sort of shadowing information. Shadow maps are an extra pass. But by doing that, you can get certain memory reductions and speed improvements. And so beyond basic maps, then there's a scattering for subsurface scattering, which tends to be baked as well. And so I guess I would say that, yeah, baking is a reality right now. It's not necessarily a convenient one, but it pays off because you can reuse those baked results across multiple frames or even multiple shots. The inconvenience comes from the disk space consumption. The I/O configuration of your giant render farm has to be able to cope with all this baked data. So those are the top of the head type considerations that lead to these bake multipass type pipelines. I think if you didn't have to bake, everyone would rather not, but it's just a budget management tool.
You mentioned the SIDGRAPH there, and one of the things that you also showed at SIDGRAPH was Traktor. Given that we're talking about incredibly large render farm with any of the companies you've mentioned, be it ILM or Weta or whatever, just in general terms, not talking about those companies in particular, can you tell us about Traktor and what that represents?
Well, Traktor is our next generation render farming tool. The predecessor for Traktor was a tool we have called Alfred, and it's still in wide use, including at Weta, to do job distribution out on a render farm. It was at Weta in particular that Alfred ran into capacity limitations, the architecture. I think most queuing systems would run into capacity problems at a place as big as Weta in terms of their render farm. So this, happened, probably hit the fan around the time of King Kong, that it became clear that the growth of the render farm was exceeding the ability of most queuing systems architectures to handle it. So it was at that time we set out to do the next generation of Alfred, and Traktor really is targeting tens of thousands of cores, sized render farms, the ability to cope with the number of transactions per second. That means the number of assignments of a given rendering to a given slot in your many tens of thousands of render farm was its first design goal. It had to be able to cope with 500 transactions per second, and it's actually gone beyond that at this point in the game. And to do that in a totally stable of a site that is, when you have, tens of thousands of cores, the odds that one of them is going to go down is actually quite large on a daily basis. Machines are fritzing out. And so any system that deals with a render farm of that size has to be more fault tolerant than a smaller system would have to be, a smaller farm would have to be. So making it fault tolerant and monitorable is a big challenge amongst any system that tries to manage so many machines. System administrators throughout the world are sort of used to trying to manage the complexity of just keeping machines running. Add to that the need to schedule the jobs on them of such size and with changing priorities, the director's coming tomorrow, and all of a sudden we have to reprioritize a bunch of shots that are on the farm. How quickly can that be done, and how much work would be lost in doing that? Those are the kinds of things these sort of next gen systems need to be coping with. And doing that in a way that they call them render wranglers, the people who try and make the farm operate for rendering at least, make that so that they can control it, whether that be from a program. They write programs to go look around the machines and identify machines that are working out of the norm or that would be good candidates for deleting a job because the director's priorities have changed, and on and on and on. that's the integration part of the problem. So, you know, Tractor is standing atop the, you know, kind of web technology, which is JavaScript-based GUIs that run in your browser through a web server and an HTTP protocol type protocol, and exactly HTTP protocol, standard protocols for communicating and programming the system, querying and command and control. So that's you know, I think that's the 3-minute pitch on Tractor. It's in beta right now, and we anticipate the 1.0 coming out in the next month, by the end of January, is our current target.
You've already indicated that there's a development cycle that'll have a, you know, Tractor 2.0, but I guess my question is how big is Tractor aimed to be able to cope with? Because if you're starting now for the next generation of farms heading out, and, you know, is the sort of exponential growth we've seen just forecast to continue, and is Tractor set up to handle that?
Well, it's coupled a little bit with the degree to which any program that it farms, any program that it distributes, is able to, you know, cope with multiple cores on a given host computer. So the two sort of are going hand in hand. PRMAN, for example, RenderMAN, is now scaling rather well up to 8 cores and beyond. And right now you really can't buy a rendering farm blade that has more than 8 cores in it. So the question from a dispatching or a scheduling point of view is, do you think of that as one unit of scheduling, or do you think of it as 8 units of scheduling? So right now, you know, we've targeted 30,000 units of scheduling as being what seems reasonable from Tractor point of view over the next 3 to 5 years. Now, if you are scheduling at the level of one thread, you know, let's say shake renders or something like that, then you should be able to keep a 30,000 frame CPU farm of one-threaded shake renders, you know, going on. But if all you're doing is PRMAN renders, you might really only want to schedule it at the level of 10,000 or fewer, 5,000 slots in your scheduling farm, each of which is running 8-threaded renders. So there's a lot of knobs, as you might imagine, with 30,000 cores out there. But that's the number we're thinking represents as big a farms, 60,000, as big a farms is going to be existing over the next 3 to 5 years. And most people that we're aware of are still well under the 10,000 core size. So and, you know, your typical small site is in the hundreds.
Yeah. While we're talking about...
I mean, small...
Yes. No, mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, not everyone's wet up. All right.
Yeah.
And thankfully, thus. But when we're talking about render farms, one of the biggest issues that's kind of on the horizon for farms generally is GPU farms, because, you know, companies like Scanline have done GPU type stuff for 2012. I'm wondering, what's Pixar or the RenderMan team's position on GPU farms?
Well, I may not be entirely up on this week's, you know, sort of GPU developments, but any GPU farm, where that means, you know, tens or hundreds of these things, that is a small form factor version of a GPU, involves an underpowered GPU. That is like a laptop GPU, as compared to what you might have in your, you know, state-of-the-art game, you know, desktop machine. The thermal output of the GPUs at the current state of the art in the high end is just such that you can't farm it. It's fundamentally unfarmable. Now, this term farm is ill-defined, and so you could have 10 or 20 or 50 regular workstations, and you can certainly call that a farm. And in that case, you're talking about probably state-of-the-art GPUs. So there's a wide range of issues, even insofar as measuring the definition of, you know, of the capacity, the compute capacity of such a thing. Right now, that is RenderMan, PRMAN, the one we sell, it does have a plug-in capability that would allow someone to write shaders that are augmented by GPU capabilities, But because that doesn't scale up into the 20,000 cores, there is no such thing as a GPU farm with 20,000 independent units. Now maybe you don't need it because they're theoretically faster with the throughput. But at least for the high-end GPU-accelerated, final film rendering is simply not even a realistic thing in the year 2009. As developers of renderers, we're looking at hardware platforms that have both the right economics in terms of people being able to build them out in the back rooms of the data centers, and have the ability to cope with the workloads that we have. And so we're certainly looking at the roadmaps of GPUs and Larrabees and AMD Fusions and all the various varieties of configurations that are being proposed by the hardware vendors. That's an active area for us to be evaluating as the years go by. But as of the year 2009, the economics seem to be pointing to the fact that a 8-core chip, maybe an Intel, what's the code name? Nehalem. Not even the high end is the sweet spot. That is, you don't go out and buy the fastest chip. You buy the most economical one, and you look at the heat and air conditioning, and all the other things that are part of the equation.
Yeah, because the promise of GPU is not just a sort of a tenfold performance thing, but it's also just the literally vast power drainage and air conditioning and infrastructure costs on a 30,000 farm is pretty astronomical. In fact, it's not that many companies can even co-locate those now. They're starting to have them off-site. So there are a lot of logistical as well as physical as well as computational reasons why trying to push through the barriers on the farms would make sense. But as you say, it's probably not something that's relevant today, though.
Well, if there's a render farm that's 30,000 cores, it really may mean that there's 12,000 chips, which may mean that there's really 3,000 blades or 4,000 blades in a farm. But you're right. I've been to the Weta render farm, and it is an amazing air conditioning unit. But if you say that the dividing factor is 10, that you can get 10 times speed up by the GPUs, it would still mean that you need a lot of GPUs. And per micron, a GPU runs hotter than some of these blade chips that know when to power down and reduce their thermal envelope and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it's pretty complex and it's changing every 3 months. So as soon as there's an obvious platform where the winds are there and you can still not be constrained by the DDR 5 megabyte, whatever the memory is that fits in the address spaces of these chips, there's lots of dimensions to this. The PCI bus address, speed and the contention with the main processor and on and on and on. So it's a complex problem. And we're looking at it just like all other rendering vendors to see whether we can look ourselves in the mirror and say that not only does our software run, it also makes all the pictures we want our customers to be able to make. Because we could certainly run some software down there and make toy pictures, but that wouldn't serve our current customer base and the complexity that they're dealing with. And they don't want to turn down their shaders, right? So if they don't want to cripple their shaders. One of the things in RenderMan 15 is the new object-oriented shading technology, and people of this sort of higher end have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of lines of shading code to be able to manage that. First off, and these shaders are high-level shaders, not GPU-type shaders. To be able to manage that has become a high point, high priority. And so better programming abstractions are being called for, and object orientation is an obvious one. Where some people miss the boat is they start saying, well, we already have C++ and it's object oriented. So what would be new of any shading language that adopts, you know, object oriented? You sort of have to think of shading languages more like assembly languages. Their goal in life is to run fast and not let bad things be able to happen, like pointer dereferences that can easily happen in C++ and crash. An object-oriented shading language is actually a pretty big deal, that at least in the high end, where needing to organize all these different BRDFs and different abstractions for lighting and different light source classifications in order to deal with all the complexity that they're delivering is necessary if you want to be able to predict the kind of picture you're going to produce through your pipeline.
If I can just turn that around on you for a second, like, let's take BRDFs, right? There's obviously a well-understood concept, but in reality, a very select group of effects houses actually get materials actually scan and use real data. I mean, they obviously do, don't get me wrong, but we're not talking about, you know, hundreds of facilities. We're talking about like a relatively small handful that are using actual data. And so there's a vast majority of companies that are like one huge level down from the Weta's and ILM's and Framestores and DNEG's. And there is absolutely no doubt that RenderMan holds a completely dominant and well-deserved position as the renderer of choice at that high-end avatar kind of level. But is there also a desire to bring a level of abstraction and thus a level of usability to those next tier facilities that are maybe, you know, not in the 30,000 render farm category and not in the... I'm not talking about amateurs, but I mean just, you know, just smaller...
Well, I want to first make sure we're on the same page with the term BRDF. There are sampled BRDFs, and I think that's what you were referring to. And then there's just procedural BRDFs, ones that compute something based on a few numbers like KS and KD.
Sure, but I mean, in terms of sampled, I mean, you obviously can do an actual sample in an actual, you know, rig.
Sure. But when I was using it, I was just saying there are ways. Area light sources, for example, interact with different shading models, if we prefer that word, whether it be a blend shading model or some sort of isotropic procedural shading model. And that the interaction between the light source shader, which might now be a multi-sampling light source, and the BRDF or the surface shading that is going on is something that it requires a certain amount of cooperation or collaboration between the surface shader and the light source shader. As these, you know, messages, the awareness of one, the light and the surface, becomes a broader pipe, the need for formalization of that communication is one of the things that these higher end folks are dealing with. Now, to address your question of trying to bring this capability and technology to a broader audience. You know, we've always tried to do that with our bridge products, and we've always tried to encourage other people to develop bridge products to bring it to the level of just your normal animator or your normal lighter or people that are sitting in front of Houdini and Maya and Softimage and 3D Max. In our particular case, we've just provided some bridge software to Maya, but I think the Houdini bridge software is also an amazing door to the RenderMan wannabe or the RenderMan user.
Houdini, and for that matter, things like Massive and stuff, lots of things are very RenderMan rib friendly, if you know what I mean.
Right, and they're approachable with a few button clicks, and you can get some amazing pictures out already, yeah.
But, of course, for some of the people listening to this, their aspirations may run ahead of their actual shader coding time experience under the belt, and I'm just trying to get a read on the priorities for the company, because obviously you'd absolutely have supported initially plugins and obviously extensions to many of these 3D apps, but is it remain an equal focus, or is the drive, you know, the...
Well, we have a tool. We have a bridge product ourselves called RenderMan for Maya, and it includes the RenderMan renderer for $995. And we've gone to a large effort to try and make the button pushers of Maya match the button pushers, the renders. You just set up your scene with the regular Maya nodes, and you get PRMN quality pictures, including all the displacements and motion blurs and nice depth of field and bokeh effects on the lens and all that. So it's a fast moving target. And people, even in the kind of just, if you will, the entry point, the small people who, many of them are incredible artists and have a great eye for stuff, they're continually pushing us from that perspective. And we're responding, I think. We're trying to keep our eye on as broad an audience as feels like it's relevant. In other words, if someone says we need a brand of light bulb shader, we'll tend to say we're just not experts on light bulb brands. And that's the kind of thing that some architectural visualization folks are interested in. They want to just put together a view of their condominium design as it would look when they buy this brand of that and that kind of paint. And that's beyond our focus as rendering providers. Now, if an integrator wanted to provide that capability using RenderMan, they could, but I don't know that there's much of that actually happening in the world. Our render is tuned to animation, and it would not be an option for us to provide a solution that didn't have the highest quality motion blur, because unless you can not strobe in animation, you don't have a solution. Renderers that don't have to deal with that particular requirement may be able to do other kinds of things that may be less important to us at this stage in the game of being really focused on film and animation.
Well, as somebody from the animation film effects in particular background, I thank the heavens that you are focused on visual effects and animation and not on a bunch of other things that might distract you from that central focus, because I think that's one of the greatest things a company can do is just have a really clear mandate and a really clear focus. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Over the last several weeks, we've taken a look at the work done by two of the main facilities on the film, ILM and Weta Digital, and today we're going to take a look at a third facility, and that's Framestore. Their work effectively encompassed three sequences. One was the Ummer Bay sequence, in which Sully is talking to the colonel inside that giant hangar next to the landing field as he puts on the robotic suit. The second scene was their nighttime escape from Hell's Gate. I think the main sequence that really served an incredibly important role in the film was effectively our arrival at Pandora's Hell's Gate. It's basically the first time we've seen the large military installation. It really sets up the scope and the feeling of what's happening on Pandora. Mike Seymour spoke with compositing supervisor from Framestore, Christian Kessner, and dove into detail about their work on this particular scene.
One of the shots I thought might be kind of nice to discuss is Sam's character, Hero, rolling down the ramp, which I believe is one of your shots when he first arrives on the planet.
Yes, it is. It's the arrival at Hell's Gate and the whole sequence once they've landed.
So let's...
It's work that we did, basically.
So I was lucky enough to actually visit on set of Avatar when they were filming in Los Angeles out near Santa Monica. And let's walk through the process, because obviously a scene like that would have been shot green screen. But there was actually live action props for some of the foreground stuff, right?
Yeah, that's correct. For that sequence, or for that shot in particular, it was just Jake in the wheelchair.
And so Jake came down a ramp that was to a ground level, and I believe the ground and the ramp were maintained as part of the composite?
Yes, that's correct. They had a practical partial set, which means there was the ramp and partial interior of the spaceship, which was called the Valkyrie, and that was practical. So he'll roll down the ramp, and then there was tarmac, but the rest of it was green screen, so everything else that you see, including the mask, the rebreather mask, were generated in CG.
So on a sequence like that, it was shot stereoscopically in terms of the live action. What were you using to solve the track?
We used a bunch of solutions, a bunch of tracking softwares. Actually, we didn't go through the whole show with just one single solution, because one package would give us the better solution. You know, it would be Fuzhou and what's the other packages. I mean, I think four or five different packages were used, depending on the shot, because our tracks had to be really, really accurate, because we were doing the vertical alignment process basically as a post process. So all our comps were then basically at the end vertically aligned, so which means all our camera tracks for left and right eye had to be extremely accurate.
So the material was, Cameron's famous for doing toe-in terms of the convergence. Did the convergence pose any problems, or was it as simple as what would have been the case if you'd done two separate camera tracks with two separate cameras?
No, just by the nature of it, you know, it's a physical rig, and you know, it's two physical cameras, and there's two different, point of focal length, and you know, they're all zoom lenses for the face camera, and it made it every slight difference made it quite difficult to, you know, to match it exactly, but. I think the biggest challenge with the towed-in shooting method is that when you shoot extra elements, that you then run into the problem that you have to match the point of convergence again.
Were you shooting extra elements for this, or was all the background synthetically generated?
No, we did shoot two extra elements for this, actually. There's some soldiers which were really, really close to cameras, which we shot as live action, because you know we didn't have the time and set up to do digital doubles this close up to camera, and also one of the M2 drivers is live action, because it was a really continuity issue where you said, like, oh, we need to have this character in this M2. So we ended up. Luckily we had the experience from Weta, where, you know, at the beginning of the whole shooting process, they were shooting and trying to pull conversions onto ocular distance for the elements as well. And then they found out that actually it's much better to shoot in a different way and to shoot with locked off conversions and do the conversions in post process, especially for elements which are fairly pretty much on one single plane and Z depth.
And where were you shooting those pickup elements, and what camera rig was it on?
It was on the Pace camera rig that James Cameron used for the rest of the show. And they actually shot it in LA, and I got to go and set for some of the interior Armor Bay live action elements that we shot. It's a different sequence, but where Jake and Colonel Courage are interacting with each other. Colonel Courage in the M-suit is a different element as well. So I went to go to the motion control shoot for that.
Yeah, and it was interesting that that not only was on set obviously doing motion capture, but it was doing the performance capture on the faces as well, but feeding that information back through for a feedback for the virtual camera. Did your work involve any of the virtual camera work?
No, we didn't really get involved into the virtual camera work, but it was interesting. It was amazing to see the set and how everything worked. And it was amazing how the workflow of digital cinema has changed.
And on your, let's get back to your workflow on that shot. So he's coming down the ramp and you've got the material and you've done the tracks now. What was the sort of pipeline for asset development and for producing the shaders and texturing? Were you going for a RenderMan finish?
Yes, we our pipeline is set up for RenderMan, and for some of the shots we were using a Mantle Ray as well, just because it was could give us a little bit of a better result, and but in general I think the biggest challenge was that it was a shared show between Weta and ILM and a few different other vendors. And most of the assets that we had were already long time developed by Weta and ILM. So for us, there was limited amount of, reinventing the wheel and, making new textures and everything involved.
So I'm curious about that. Were you producing the stereoscopic renders out of RenderMan by using stereo shaders, or were you basically just rendering two passes, one for each camera?
Well, we've written our own proprietary tools and shaders, so some of the shaders would be able to resolve stereo issues, but some of the stuff had to be rendered out, and it had to be calculated for each eye separately.
And is your pipeline a multi-pass pipeline, or you're aiming to get pretty much all of it through the render? How compositive intensive was it?
I think Framestore has always been, a known compositing house, and we always try to get, as close as possible as we can in the CG result, and but usually what comes out of on the CG side and the beauty is usually a really, really good starting point. But we do have a multipass setup, and I have a lot of control in comp where we can, dial specularity or diffuse or ambient contribution up and down a little bit, or animate, as needed.
Were the scenes of the environment that they landed at Hellscape, was that stuff computationally tough? Did you have to do any baking in or like shadow pre-comp sort of stuff, or was it all... Because obviously the film got very, very rich and very dense in areas, and computationally would have been a slammer for any render farm.
Yes, I think we ended up optimizing as good as we can, because nothing would basically render out of the box everything together, and it's a huge show, and so if you will, it's almost it's a full photorealistic full CG feature, and especially I think that shot you were talking about where he rolls down the ramp, and the one when he comes out of the ramp, I mean there are up to 46 different layers of CG that we ended up splitting out just because we would hit the limits of the render farm where we would not be able to render things out. But approaching strategically and what isn't good to split out, and backgrounds, foregrounds element, what needs interacting, and where do the effects come in, and all these things. I mean, it was a huge undertaking to get one of those shots done, but it was a great experience too.
And then when you had those elements out of RenderMan, you were compositing in Nuke?
Yes, we started using Nuke at Framestore about over a year ago. We did some earlier tests, maybe 2 years back, but Quantum of Solace was literally our first show that we fully run in Nuke. And now looking back, we couldn't have done Avatar without Nuke, I think. And it's just such a... pipeline-friendly software, which allowed us to just build the pipeline the way we thought the stereoscopic pipeline needed to be built. And then, a Nuke would be highly adaptable using Python. All the tools that were written were, usable in Nuke as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem, isn't it, stereo? I mean, for example, just rotoing and managing to make sure that both sides are absolutely identical, as opposed to sort of what would be more forgiving in a mono. Did you have any issues with roto or trying to line up for any of that kind of manual work?
Yes. I think the largest thing for the show was actually the factor of the unknown. We had never done a stereoscopic to this extent before, and we were thrown into one of the most anticipated projects, but this was a huge challenge. But there was always the factor of the unknown, and especially for rotoscoping, how do we approach it? And are there tools that actually will help us solve these problems? And there are various, ways of solutions which we found out how to approach this. And some of them was, we can actually roto in 3D space in Nuke. That was quite was quite good. And some of it was Ocular helping us, we can translate this disparity maps one eye to the other. But I think any just by nature, any accurate roto, especially rotoing on people or fine detail, was done for each eye separately as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Ocular, whether or not you were using Ocular and whether you found it to be good, because, of course, that would have been Ocular 1. We're sort of looking to Ocular 2 now, but how did you find Ocular?
Ocular, I think, helped us in many ways, and last but not least, in the finishing process, most of all, where we vertical line our shots to only be horizontally offset and just you know, given the fact that we had camera tracks for all the shots, and you could generate quite accurate disparity maps with the Oculus solver, and then we would be able to vertical line. But I think it became, Oculus became a separate process pipeline. Basically, it wouldn't live live in our comps.
And tell me, when you're doing your work in the Nuke pipeline, how are you viewing work in stereo in terms of just the workflow for a compositor?
Most of the stuff we had a couple of setups using shutter glasses, and we had what we would call puppet theater. It's a true 3D eye station, which is two 24-inch LCD monitors with a polarized mirror. So we would actually be able to have, you know, desk reviews. We had two viewing stations, desk reviews, to see the stuff in, you know, stereo, full res, and linear polarized. And then also we have our daily cinema downstairs, where we would go see everything in real D. But the compositing process itself would mostly be in 2D, because, you know, each eye for itself had to hold up, and just making sure that everything works in 3D. Just then every now and then you would go render your shutter in 3D and review it for yourself.
How was the colorimetry between the two left and right eyes? Because had they been balanced at all? Because we've talked about it in terms of spatial alignment, but in terms of density and matching in terms of color, was that something that you were dealing with?
Yes, there's, you know, just by nature, where, with the PACE camera, that one of the cameras going through a polarization, which means that some speculars are different in one eye than the other, and then some color is different in one eye or the other. But we would take care of most of that. It was just grading.
And was that done by eye, or did you use any plugins?
We did most of it by eye. Just the compositors would, you know, for each shot they would balance them out, because the differences are not huge, and you know, just color collect each eye to the other.
And then for delivery, what was the pipeline when a shot was approved? I assume that because you're working in London, you were doing some kind of remote approval process back to Jim Cameron.
Yes, we had basically weekly reviews with the supervisors, and with later on with James Cameron. And James would final our shots in 2D, and so we would go through either CineSync sessions or Polycom sessions. He would sit in his Avid, go through everything, watch everything in HD, and say, well, give us comments and feedback and approve our shots in 2D. And all the 3D approval process was a later stage, where once everything, the whole sequence was approved in 2D, he would go through and do a 3D review. Of course, we would have, you know, quality control on our side before we would send anything 3D to them.
And presumably there was an entire sort of discussion to be had about, you know, at what point the stereo effect was converging and how much it was, you know, sitting back from the screen or whatever. I mean, I must admit, I thought the 3D in this film was just faultless. It was so good. It was so immersive, as opposed to being gimmicky. It was terrific.
Yeah, that's one of the things I enjoyed the most as well. Is I went to see Avatar with the premiere, actually, and you just, you know, you just there and you just take it in, and it was just great use of 3D without, as you say, without being gimmicky. But I think most of the convergence and everything was driven by James Cameron's direction, because he would give us suppliers templates with previs and 3D animation and everything. So, but that also had two cameras in there, and also had point of convergence and focus pull in the way he wanted it. So we were basically directed in that sense, that we didn't have much leeway.
So, you know, it's such an interesting process, and so sort of cutting edge. I wonder, looking back on the process now, if you were tackling another, you know, sort of major visual effects live action project like this, is there anything you'd do differently?
I think as I said earlier, the largest or the most scary factor was the unknown. I think just having gone through such a huge project, there's a lot of, you know, things that we've learned. Would I do things differently? I don't know. I think it was great. I think we were partially benefiting from the fact that this project had been in pipeline for so long and had been in development for so long that we didn't have the hard learning curve that Weta probably had when I first started doing this, because we had an exchange in brief, and we benefited from the experience.
Yeah, I think that obviously, a lot has been clarified from doing it. I wonder, was there any application here where you sort of needed to develop more specialized tools? I mean, is there anything sort of like unusual, I guess, that came up that you hadn't anticipated, even though, you had quite a lot at your disposal from the other companies?
No, I think, the most development I think in, for us was the pipeline itself, and how to deal with such a huge amount of assets and combination of live action and extra elements, and decide what holds up, where can we use actual 2D elements, what is far away enough from camera, and how can we use 2D elements in 3D space to make to sit them in the correct space. And I think the combination of live action with another live action element, that was kind of the area where we put a lot of work and thought into how do we resolve different points of convergence and all these kind of things.
So if you're budgeting to do a couple of shots for some project that came along, if it was going to be a stereo shoot nuke composite pipeline like this as opposed to a 2D, what sort of overhead would, just as a percentage, like budget-wise, do you feel like it's a 5-10% kind of thing, or is it like, I presume it's not double the amount of work?
No, I wouldn't say double, but it's really hard to tell because we found out that, some of the shots were only, 20% more work, and some of the shots were like three times the amount of work. It really depends on how well it is prepared, how many elements come together, and I don't think there's a rule of thumb, really, that say, any stereoscopic show you can bid, times and a half or two times or three times. I would say, it really depends on the individual shots and what actually goes into a show like this.
Hmm. Well, look, thank
really,
you.
It's really, really hard to tell that to give you a number to say, this is like three times.
Yeah, because, it's just such a new area. I think people are just really interested.
It's such
to
a
get
new
it.
Area, and once you say it's one plate, and it's the rest is CG, that just comes out a lot easier than say, there's a plate and an extra element, because then you have to do tracking for both of the plays and have to match convergence together and all these kind of things. So I think there's no rule of thumb, really.
Well, look, I think this film's terrific, really absolutely stunning, and the stereo is surprisingly perhaps the thing I was thinking about least while watching it, because it was just so impressive and so visually dense. So thank you so much for taking time to talk to us about it.
Yes, thank you so much, and I agree. And when I saw it, I didn't want it to end, and people were saying, it's a three-hour movie, I don't want to sit in the theater for 3 hours with glasses. And it actually turned out to be very, very watchable. And, I think one of the major differences is that he directed it the way he would direct a regular movie rather than doing a CG feature. I think I really, really enjoyed the visual experience, and it should really be, experienced in 3D.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks. Good for talking to you. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that wraps up our three-part look at the feature film Avatar. Hope you've enjoyed it. I know Mike had a great time interviewing the various parties involved, and it's been great hearing from those of you who've enjoyed the podcasts as well. We've posted quite a few shorter stories and articles on Effects Guide about works being done by various facilities around the world. So even if you haven't checked out Effects Guide lately, be sure to do so. We've also gotten great reviews regarding our new term over at our training site, fxphd.com. It's really going gangbusters, and we've got a slate of great courses. So if you haven't checked it out, head on over. Well, that's it for this week. Until next time, for my partners Mike Seymour and Jeff Huser, thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.